Former National Security Advisor to President Trump, Mike Flynn, will be sentenced today for lying to the FBI. Political junkie Ken Rudin joins us to share his thoughts on that and several other topics, including a potential government shutdown. It's the holiday season, and that includes the African-American tradition of Kwanzaa. The Reverend Ambrose Carroll, founder of Green the Church, joins us in studio with a cultural look at the week-long celebration and the subject of CTE, a disease caused by repetitive brain injuries, is at the center of a new play by Sacramento's B Street Theater. We'll speak with the man who is cast as a former football star in Halftime with Dawn. I'm Randall White in for Beth Ruyak on this Tuesday. That is today on Insight. From CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Randall White, and today for Beth Ruyak, Washington, D.C. is abuzz today as former National Security Advisor to President Trump, Mike Flynn, will be sentenced for lying to the FBI about his contacts with Russian officials as the president was preparing to take office. Joining us today is political junkie Ken Rudin. Ken, welcome to Insight.
Good morning, Randall.
And Ken, before we get to Flynn, something NPR has been reporting today, Donald Trump has decided to shut down his Trump Foundation. What are your thoughts on that?
He decided to shut that foundation because basically there are ongoing investigations, mostly led by the New York State Attorney General, that say that Trump has been using this foundation as a piggy bank for his own personal needs to pay off legal settlements, to make campaign contributions. They're saying that everything Trump has done with this foundation is illegal. Trump apparently has agreed to close down the foundation, and the money will be dispersed to nonprofit agencies. But the investigation continues into how Trump and his family may have personally benefited from this foundation.
Yeah, the during one of the NPR newscasts, they referred to it as a personal checkbook. There is documentation to prove this?
Oh, there is. As a matter of fact, otherwise Trump wouldn't have acceded so quickly. I think that reminds me a little bit of his willingness to settle that Trump University fraud claim as well, because he knew that the evidence was against him. But if he thinks that by disbanding the foundation, his legal problems will go away, he's mistaken, because the State Attorney General of New York has made it clear that she will insist on finding, taking this investigation to its logical conclusion, which could mean indictment. So watch this story, because it's not going away anytime soon.
All right, Ken, let's get to Mike Flynn's scheduled day for today. Prosecutors are recommending no jail time in exchange for his cooperation with several investigations. How serious are these charges?
Well, they are serious in the fact that, I mean, Michael Flynn otherwise wouldn't have, look, he pleaded guilty a long time ago about lying to the FBI about his connections and his conversations with the ambassador to the UN, mostly during the, about the Obama sanctions and what kind of deal the incoming Trump administration and Russia could work out. Now, of course, Trump says no collusion, and this is not really, exactly what we were talking about Russian influence into the campaign. But it does show that another top level person in the Trump administration, Flynn being the former national security advisor, could face jail time, or at least pleads guilty for lying to the FBI. And so much for talking about draining the swamp. I remember Michael Flynn's famous strutting on the stage at the Republican convention in 2016, with the delegates serenading him with "Lock Her Up," talking about Hillary Clinton. And he said, "Boy, if I did do anything that Hillary Clinton did, I'd be in prison today." Well, it doesn't look like he's going to prison. Both the prosecutors and the defense are urging no prison time because of his cooperation. But that's what's interesting, because President Trump tweeted today that he said, "Good luck today in court, and I'm with you and everything," even though Flynn has cooperated pretty extensively with Mueller. And yet when Michael Cohen did the same thing, of course, Cohen is a liar and a cheat and a traitor. So it's interesting the two different approaches Trump has to his former henchman.
Yeah, and the president in his tweets today also said it will be interesting to see what Flynn has to say, despite tremendous pressure being put on him about Russian collusion in, and then this, these are his words, in our great and obviously highly successful political campaign. And then he followed that up with the repeated no collusion exclamation.
Doesn't it sound like the, it sounds like the, I said, I slipped a second ago talking about the Soviet Union when I meant Russia, of course, but it does sound like those old Soviet, you know, our great exalted leaders and our great successful campaign, even while millions and millions of people were starving in the Soviet Union. It just somehow the Trump language on some of these tweets just sound like from a different era, and it's a bit eerie, but. You know, what else new, right?
Ken, I think we're going to switch to the phones here while we play this clip from Senator Ron Wyden, a Democrat from Oregon, was on NPR this morning with David Greene. He seems to think Flynn should face consequences. Let's hear what he had to say.
Michael Flynn is an adult. He was a general. He lied to the FBI. That is now indisputable. And I'm sure there can be lots of debates about various motivations for what he's done in the last few days. Maybe he wants this to affect his sentence. Maybe he's hoping for a pardon. But to me, what everybody ought to see as their takeaway is the real consequences for lying to the FBI, as there should be.
But Ken, there aren't going to be consequences, are there? At least not in the sentencing today?
That's my understanding. And I think one of the reasons why, look, I understand what Senator Wyden is talking about. But obviously, for the prosecution to recommend against jail time makes me think that the information that Flynn gave the prosecutors, that gave Robert Mueller and all the rest of the prosecution team, what he gave them was extremely valuable enough to decide that maybe that makes up for, that'll make up for the lack of prison time that otherwise would be recommended. Remember, even though Michael Cohen ostensibly is cooperating, he will, you know, he was sentenced to 3 years in jail because he apparently didn't tell everything he knows. There's a sense that Flynn did tell everything he knows and has been extremely forthcoming.
An NBC Wall Street Journal poll finds 62% of Americans think President Trump is not telling the truth about the Russia probe. How does public perception play into this?
Well, I'd like to know about the 38% that doesn't feel that feels he is telling the truth. And look, you know, I don't know what it means. We did see a little bit what it meant last November when the Democrats picked up 40 seats in the House. A lot of areas that had voted for President Trump in 2016 threw out Republican congressmen and put in Democrats. So I guess that's one way of looking at it. And, of course, the fact is that whatever we know or don't know about Donald Trump telling the truth, I think we're going to learn a lot more next year, or at least next month. What am I saying? Next month, January 3rd, when the Democrats take over control of the House. And when they do that, they will have power of investigation and subpoena and calling witnesses for testimony and things like that, something that the Republican-controlled House certainly wasn't willing to do in 2017 and 2018. So if you know, given the fact that the American people feel that the president is not telling the truth, given the fact that Mueller seems to be getting closer with these guilty pleas and these sentencings, and the fact that the Democrats are going to take over the House, it is going to be, I think, a much more disturbing picture for the president and for the Republican Party. And you may, I don't know what you'll see that, if you'll see more distractions, if you'll see more foreign policy crises coming about. But I suspect that it's not going to be a good year for the Republican Party and the president. I mean, you know, I don't buy the argument that he's about to be impeached and replaced anytime soon, because I think the last president who was impeached and replaced was nobody. It never happened. So give up, you know, those people who think that Trump is going to be removed from office by a Republican, by a now Republican Senate, forget about it. But the fact is, his life will not be made much easier with the investigators getting closer and closer to him.
Chris Matthews on MSNBC had speculated that he might resign to protect his daughter and son-in-law from convictions.
Yeah, well, first of all, I hope you're the last person ever to quote Chris Matthews. But having said that, look, I can't see him, You know, I was wondering, even if he had lost to Hillary Clinton, whether he would have accepted the results. I don't see him leaving early. I don't see him resigning. I think he, and maybe in his heart of hearts, he believes what he's saying, and there's no way he's going to be forced out, regardless of the facts. But I kind of think that in many cases we've seen in the past 2 years that the president will insist on things. Look, Putin was not involved, despite what our intelligence agencies say about interference in the 2016 election. So the facts be damned. I don't see him pulling anything that Chris Matthews suggests.
And Ken, a report out this week shows Russia was in deep on social media, utilizing every platform available and targeting African Americans in the run-up to the election for several months after, even trying to discredit Robert Mueller. What are your takeaways from that report?
Well, it's still going on now. Well, first of all, we should make a point of saying this does not prove collusion. This does not prove that the fact that Donald Trump was working with the Russians, but it's clear from all the things that Russia has done on social media, on Instagram, on Twitter, on Facebook, all the other platforms, that they did everything they could to not only elect Donald Trump, and they put that on right-wing sites with fake identities, but on left-wing sites, they targeted African Americans, saying Hillary Clinton has sold them out. They targeted Bernie Sanders supporters, saying that Hillary Clinton is supported by the KKK. I mean, some of them are just beyond belief. But they clearly, Russia had it in its interest to elect Donald Trump, defeat Hillary Clinton, and they did whatever they could, and that includes targeting African Americans, targeting Bernie Sanders supporters, saying that Hillary Clinton was part of the enemy and deserves to be defeated. And as you say, Randall, it's still going on now. It's disinformation campaign about Robert Mueller and all the fake charges that are being made against him. I mean, you know, God bless social media, and it's great for democracy, but sometimes there's a little too much democracy in social media that people believe what they see, and that's always a risk.
We're speaking with political junkie Ken Rudin about all of the news coming out of Washington, D.C., and there is a lot of it. We are just days away from a partial government shutdown if Congress doesn't approve funding, and there appears to be no plan to stop it, and that's coming from several Republican lawmakers who still control both houses. Everyone is apparently waiting on President Trump to lay out the next step. Is the main sticking point still funding for the border wall with Mexico?
Oh, that's all of it. That's what it is. I mean, Trump, you know, once he decides that this is going to happen, he'll make sure it happens. Stephen Miller, his top security policy advisors, said that we will do whatever it takes to build that wall, and if we have to shut down the government, we will. And that is Trump's philosophy. But as you quote, you know, the other Republicans say, we have no idea what's going on. There's no indication from the president that any new plan is coming. Sarah Huckabee Sanders did indicate that maybe the administration could go around Congress and gather enough money to fund the wall, which it seems like a little, an end run around Congress, which I don't think Republicans will be happy about. But right now, the President Trump, as he said last Tuesday in his meeting with Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer, that, look, you know, I will take responsibility for it. I will shut down the government if I don't get my wall. And right as of now, he's still planning to do that. But my gut tells me that's not going to happen. There'll probably be one of those CRs they always talk about, the continuing resolutions, a short-term solution that maybe they'll fund it for 2 weeks and talk a little further. But the closer we get to 2019, the more power the Democrats have, because they'll have the House. And I think that, you know, if the Republicans want to make a deal now, this is probably a better chance for them to make a deal better to their liking than they will get in January. But again, the wall is a no deal for the Democrats, and that's what Trump is stuck with.
Ken, you mentioned Senator Chuck Schumer. He had comments today regarding President Trump not being on the same page as the rest of the Republicans.
Nor have we even heard from our Republican colleagues in the Senate or House about what they might support to avoid a shutdown. Senate Republican leadership has no idea what President Trump wants. Neither does House Republican leadership.
Does that indicate, Ken, that a shutdown is likely, at least a partial shutdown?
Well, I honestly don't know. I mean, this, you know, I don't want to have Chuck Schumer speaking for the Republican Party, but as you said earlier, the Republicans like John Cornyn, who's the number two Republican in the Senate, said we haven't got any instructions at all from what the president wants. So it feels like that we're on the way to a shutdown, perhaps maybe a short-term shutdown. Of course, most of the government is already funded, although Department of Homeland Security and others like that are not. So it would only be a partial shutdown. And as far as political implications, we always talk about when the Republicans shut down the government in 2013. This was a Ted Cruz effort because it's to stop Obamacare. And, of course, the Republicans got a lot of hell for it. And in 2014, they picked up 63 seats in the House. So short-term political fallout was very brief for the Republicans in 2013. I'm not convinced how long it'll be in 2018 and 2019. But right now, it looks like it's up to the President Trump to stop this shutdown if he wants to.
A federal judge in Texas struck down President Obama's Affordable Care Act back on Friday. Most of us know it nowadays as Obamacare. The judge says the mandate requiring people to buy health care is unconstitutional, so the rest of the law can't stand without it. Democratic leaders in several states plan to appeal, and it will likely end up before the Supreme Court. But where do we go in the meantime, Ken?
Well, nothing changes in the meantime. First of all, this is be careful what you wish for, because ever since Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act was passed in 2010, Republicans have been saying, we got to stop it, we have to repeal it, we have to get rid of it, and they never could. Of course, they were never going to do it when Obama was president, and they couldn't get the votes to do it when Trump is president, as we learned with the John McCain, Lisa Murkowski, and Susan Collins voting no on the repeal effort. But when you have a federal judge, a conservative judge, who said, let's get rid of Obamacare and let's strike down the entire law, you would think the Republicans would think it's great news. But the fact is that a lot of people rely on the Affordable Care Act for insurance. It guarantees pre-existing conditions, which is so important to many Americans. 20 million Americans get insured in insurance through Obamacare. And so, even at the end of the campaign last year, while the Republicans were on the defensive about health care, they suddenly changed their tune and said, oh, no, we're all for pre-existing conditions. We definitely want to protect that. And this judge is not bound by any popular notion, popular votes. He said, let's get rid of the whole thing. And the Democrats said, wait a second, I think we think we just got the greatest political gift. I know that sounds cynical, but they did get a political gift if they get rid of Obamacare. So let's see what happens. Let's see where it goes in the courts. But right now, I'm not convinced that the Republicans, who have been wishing for the demise of Obamacare all this time, suddenly like what the judge in Texas has proposed.
Yeah, some polls show public approval as high as 6 out of 10 people just as recently as last month. So.
Yeah, remember, back in the day, when Obamacare, when the Affordable Care Act was passed, it was very, very unpopular. Democrats knew it, but they just couldn't get the political will to open up the process all over again. But now, even if it is unpopular, it's still popular, more popular than any alternative, because there is no alternative. So suddenly the ugliness of the ACA, the Affordable Care Act, which everybody was saying is so terrible, suddenly it's become popular and needed and necessary. And Republicans had better learn that before 2020, or they're going to find themselves in another debacle like they did last month.
Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke, who was just in Chico here recently following the Camp wildfire, will leave office at the end of the year following a string of investigations into ethics issues. Is this fallout from the Democrats winning the House?
That's my guess. Look, he's been under a lot of investigations for the longest time, a lot of things about conflicts of interest, a lot of business decisions that benefited his families. But he knew, and he knows, that with the Democrats taking over in January, they suddenly would start investigating him even further. There are Justice Department investigations going in on him, but just because he resigned, I still don't think that the Democrats are going to back away from investigating what happened. And of course, I saw on Twitter, I think today, that some progressive lefty or something was saying, this is great news, we got rid of Zinke. Well, the person replacing Zinke is going to be his deputy, who was an oil and a former oil and gas lobbyist. So if he thinks that anything is going to change policy-wise with Ryan Zinke gone, the president has a lot of things coming. But ethically, Zinke was in trouble, and I'm not convinced his problems go away just because he resigned his office.
Ken, let's just talk briefly about the new acting White House chief of staff, Mick Mulvaney. He is currently the director of the Office of Management and Budget. This has been a really hard position for the president to fill.
It's impossible to be a chief of staff in an administration where the president acts as his own chief of staff. And I said that about Secretary of State and Secretary of Defense as well. That's who Donald Trump is. So if the job is of John Kelly was to come in and instill order, he failed to do that. Mick Mulvaney is less interested in instilling order, less about talking between Democrats and Republicans. Mulvaney is more of a Trump loyalist, very conservative. He'll back Trump all the way. And one thing you can guarantee, there won't be the screaming matches that we heard between Trump and Kelly. Mulvaney and Trump seem to be on the same page.
Ken, this is our last time chatting for the year. What are some of the stories that surprised you in 2018?
Well, nothing surprises me anymore because, I mean, it's just been so just an unbelievable year. One thing, since we are ending the year off with this program, I'd like to talk about just briefly just a mention of the people we lost, the George Bush, Barbara Bush, John McCain. There were some giants. There was George Duke Majan as well, Ron Dellums from California. But there were a lot of people who really worked to make this country a better place, and you know, whatever you liked or didn't like about George Bush during his presidency, he is remembered more fondly, and John McCain as well, for civility, decency, and the belief that government can work. And I think that while I'm not looking ahead to talking about this, but I want to say that we will miss them tremendously.
Stories that you're watching closely for 2019, I'm just going to take a stab at it and say the Mueller investigation.
The Mueller investigation, and see how long the shutdown lasts, if at all.
Political junkie Ken Rudin. Ken, thanks so much, as always, for being on Insight. Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year.
Same to you, Randall, to you and your family, and to the listeners. Thank you.
And, of course, we have more on our website. You can find that at capradio.org/insight. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio. You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm Randall White in for Beth Riack today. The African-American week-long holiday celebration known as Kwanzaa kicks off a week from tomorrow and runs through New Year's Day. Saturday, December the 29th, the California State Capitol will host its annual Kwanzaa event at noon. Polling shows millions of Americans celebrate the holiday, but as a percentage of the total population, it's still only in the single digits. So here this morning to educate us on Kwanzaa, its origins and traditions, is the Reverend Ambrose Carroll, founder of Green the Church. Welcome to Insight. Nice to have you here.
Thank you.
And Michael Harris, the California State Capitol Kwanzaa coordinator and co-chair of the California Black Agriculture Working Group. Welcome to Insight to you as well.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Really nice to bring you here into the Insight studios to talk about this. Kwanzaa is now celebrated around the world, but it got its start, if I have my history correct, it got its start in California in 1966. Reverend, can you tell us a bit about the celebration and how it came to be?
All right. Well, I'll defer to Brother Harris on that.
Oh, okay.
Well, the idea that our California-grown holiday, Kwanzaa, was in fact a product of first fruits of the harvest, which is right out of the Bible. The founder of Kwanzaa was a chicken farmer. His father was in Maryland. And so, you know, part of his education, early education, was grounded in the agricultural lifestyle. And that was synthesized with Pan-African agricultural celebrations and came out of the Watts riot. So it's a very unique California-grown, uniquely American holiday that we celebrate now all around the world.
So there was a lot of tension down in the Los Angeles area in the mid-60s. We had the riots, and I guess there was a desire for some healing, and that's where Kwanzaa came from?
Well, yes. It was a desire for healing in a holistic sense, that we have people of African descent that don't really have a connection to their African ancestry because of the history here in America. We could go through the legacy of enslavement. We could go through the legacy of Jim Crow and some of the dynamics specific to California, just, you know, a unique set of institutional racism that we're still dismantling today here in California. But out of the Watts riots, the civil rights struggle, this was very positive. And today, it is something that people live every day in their lifestyle. You know, people are looking for healthy food. People are looking for, you know, a holistic lifestyle, getting back to natural food. And that's where First Fruits of the Harvest comes alive now.
Would you say it's a bit of an annual history lesson, a time to reflect on traditions that may have been lost over the past couple hundred years?
Well, it's yes and no. The idea that in 1966, there was no African history program. There wasn't any museums of African culture. And so today, we have that in some schools year-round. And so the idea is have Kwanzaa year-round and for everybody to understand what it is. Currently, the standards and practice of California talk with our kids, all of our kids, introduce Black culture through the prism of slavery. And that's something we have to change today because it doesn't reflect the great legacy people of African descent had, you know, prior to the, you know, institution of slavery.
Right. Mm. Reverend, this is an African-American celebration. Are other races and cultures invited to celebrate it, too, or does that start to venture into the area of cultural appropriation?
You know, growing up in America, growing up myself in Oakland, California, we celebrate America. So it doesn't matter if it's Chinese New Year, doesn't matter if it's St. Patrick's Day, right? Everybody has on green.
Right.
We expect those same notions. And just depending, of course, we take our own deep dive, but the history, it's about living. We definitely believe that, you know, we are all but one humanity. And the more that we learn about one another, as we learn about ourselves, I think it just enriches life itself.
And it can be used as a learning experience for the community, right? An opportunity to invite your neighbors into the house and say, hey, these are some of our traditions. This is our history. This
yeah.
is where we came from.
Yeah.
Those sorts of things.
Of course. Of course. Always open. Always an empty chair at the table. Definitely.
Is there a religious element to Kwanzaa?
Oh, we believe that religion and spirituality and community and life are all one. In Africa, there are places where there's no, you know, there's no dichotomy between sacred and secular. And I think, you know, growing up in the West, we kind of have a way of dividing those things out.
No, that's true.
And I think yeah. a part of our teaching and a part of this being so entrenched to what we're doing with Green the Church is kind of taking us back to some of those realities. Growing up, a lot of our foreparents as sharecroppers and things of that nature, the same personalities who were the preachers and the deacons were also the farmers and the ranchers. And so there was a oneness. And we really, Kwanzaa is a way of us reflecting that even in faith spaces.
Let's talk about how that's reflected a little bit going down through. It's a week-long celebration, right? It's 7 days. Walk us through those days and what's significant about each one.
Well, there's 7 days, 7 principles, and 7 symbols of Kwanzaa. And you know, a lot of people get lost because it's based in a Swahili language. And there's confusion there, but it's real simple. The first day of Kwanzaa is, and I'll just use English, is unity, self-determination, collective work and responsibility, cooperative economics, purpose, creativity, and faith. And then, you know, there's 7 symbols. The Mkeka, well, there I go with
the Swahili, right?
But it's a straw mat. And then there's a candle holder. There's 7 candles. There's a unity cup. There is a gift. There is fruit. And there's corn, and those symbols are, you know, indicative of a harvest celebration. And you light the candle, one candle for each day, and you want to make this a interactive, you know, with the youth exchange. And so that's what we're, you know, moving past that to do it year round. And we're, you know, we're partnering with Sojourner Truth African Museum and Performing Arts Academy to do it year round, where there's a cafe inside the museum. And we're partnering with like Fresher Sacramento, the Sacramento Food Bank, and of course expanding the capacity of Black agricultural producers for a year round celebration of Kwanzaa. And it's first fruits of the harvest, so we're looking at, you know, unique fruits. So like the muscadine grape and matunda ya Kwanzaa, that's what first fruits of the harvest means in Swahili. And so it's a super fruit, and it has high antioxidants that gives, you know, the optimal health benefits. So here in America, we have diet-related disease, and in Africa, we have depleted immune systems. So if we go back to the Bible and, you know, have workers in the vineyard, parable of the workers in the vineyard, where people are growing the number one superfruit with the highest antioxidants, first fruits of harvest comes alive.
The produce that's featured through Kwanzaa, is it easy to find locally? Are there shops that specialize in this sort of thing?
Well, the shop is the farm, you know, the plant, as we call it. And the production capacity of African-American farmers has been diminished over time. The production capacity in Africa has been diminished. And that's why we partner with the church, because the church has the numbers. The church has the historic storehouse where you bring the first fruits of your harvest to the church. Mm. That's where the scriptures come in. And that's why it's essential for us to go back to the scriptures. And it's not just Christianity. It's most religions have a first fruits of the harvest celebration. This just particular celebration is through the prism lens of a Pan-African culture, which just simply means where Black people are all over the planet. And people get lost in that, but we've been dispersed all over the planet. Some of it our own doing with, you know, explorations, and some of it through slavery, and some of it we just today get on a plane and say, I want to move there. But we happen to be everywhere, and that's what we mean by Pan-African diaspora.
And you mentioned the term Kwanzaa is Swahili. That was intentional, right? That's an East African language, while much of the slave trade was focused on West Africa, and that was part of that Pan-African effort to, was it not?
Yeah, that's exactly true. Swahili is not singularly with one tribe or one nation. It's a trade language, and it provides a positive experience where we could talk to each other and not have to deal with some of the historical challenges. And ironically, it's the money. The gold coins in Angola is the Kwanzaa with 1A.
Are there specific foods that are associated? You talked about the different forms of produce, but are there dishes that have become directly connected with the celebration that you expect to have during that week?
Well, I'll ask Dr. Ambrose to talk about the food that he ate when he was growing up at the church, because that's really what it's about.
Well, food brings us together, right? It's an international language.
Food definitely brings us together, and food is theological, right, as well. And I think it is one of the most beautiful things. We talk about soul food, and growing up, my dad would talk about his mother's biscuits, right? Or you would talk about the greens and the pot liquor from those greens and all of the nutrients that you would get. You would talk about the yams, right? And we'd sweet potato pies instead of pumpkin pies.
Right.
you talk about things that even have been caricatures, like watermelon, right? And, you know, Black folk like watermelon. But I remember being 8, 9 years old in Holly, Louisiana, busting them wide open and eating them with seeds in them. The tragedy of our movement to northern cities is we began to eat watermelons with no seeds. Mm. And what does that mean? We used to know where they came from, But now there's a generation that we don't know where the food comes from. We're growing up in what's called food deserts. And even in church, our celebration around food has really been watered down, where now instead of eating something that is very nutritious, we're now eating a lot of food-like substances. And because we do that in church, if it's Kool-Aid and fried chicken, then we do that at home, which drives up diabetes, which exacerbates our asthma. And so it is a relearning, a renewal. Kwanzaa gives us an opportunity for the ceremonies around land that a lot of people left the South and decided, I'm never going back. I'm never going to pick any more cotton. I don't want my children in any field. And we miss something because it is the land that kept us. It is the land that connected us to spirit. And over the last 40 years, it is moving away from that. And it is caught up in these marginalized places in society, these ghettos that were created for us, right, that we were locked into, to the point where we no longer know where our food comes from. We turn on lights, but we don't know where the energy comes from. And this is us retaking responsibility and joining the table of humanity to take responsibility for everything.
And an opportunity to reconnect with the land and
definitely
where the food comes from. We're definitely speaking with the Reverend Ambrose Carroll, founder of Green the Church, and Michael Harris, the California State Capitol Kwanzaa coordinator, about the week-long celebration known as Kwanzaa. Are there polls or studies to show whether young people are connecting with this holiday?
I'm sure there are. The reality for me is, you see the supermarkets and people want natural food. People are moving to a vegan lifestyle. People don't want animal base in their diet. People want, cars that are cleaner. We look at climate change and we can all attest to what's going on in our environment. And so, you know, the principles of Kwanzaa have been sharing this for a long time. The indigenous cultures have been talking about, you know, taking care of, you know, Mother Earth or grandfather. So Kwanzaa is, you know, again, just a unique expression through the prism of African culture, and people of African descent haven't had the time or the energy to worry about, you know, environmental justice because they've been trying to, you know, just pay the bills and keep, you know, a roof over their head. So now there's a number of people that, you know, have taken advantage of that and are leading the forefront of environmental justice because there's been a challenge in our communities, hardest hit by, you know, the degradation of the environment. So, yes, Kwanzaa, again, it's part of a holistic lifestyle change. It's not just for the holiday is the 7 days of the at the end of the year, but it's something you live your life through. Mm. And it's the basis. It's not the end of it. It's the basis.
It's interesting, the point that you made, that it's a luxury to have those concerns regarding the environment and whether your food's organic or not.
Sure.
Well, if you know, the Farm Bill just passed, is $867 billion. And, you know, the biggest contentious argument is about supplemental nutrition assistance program. And some people did not eat last night. So to say, OK, we're going to take care of folks with supplemental that didn't eat, you know, there's a big gap in terms of where we are with reality and where the policy is. And so we have to be intentional on changing that. So if we're going to have a planet Earth, we need to start with the lowest because there's a lot of people didn't eat last night.
Michael, is this Capitol celebration one of the larger Kwanzaa celebrations in the state?
Not in the state. It's there's so many Kwanzaa celebrations now and throughout the region of Northern California. We'll be at capacity in the largest room in the Capitol on Saturday. But there's, you know, it starts on
a
the
26th. A week from Saturday, right?
The 29th.
Okay,
yes, good. A week from this Saturday. And then there's a host of workshops and events all around Northern California. It's growing, so the events don't be so large as in the past they have been. But 350 seats in the Capitol, I'm sure we're going to have a festive occasion. We have the president of the California Baptist Convention, and I'll let Dr. Carroll talk about that a little bit.
Definitely. It comes in a beautiful time, and Kwanzaa, all faith traditions All the nominations will be present. But the week after Christmas, for the last 30 years, the California State Baptist Youth and Young Adult Convention comes together, oftentimes in Fresno. This year, we will be in Sacramento from the 26th through the 29th, which is about 700 young people in the city. And so our president, Reverend Welton Pleasant, pastor of Christ Second Baptist Church in Long Beach, will be present. He's going to be one of our keynote speakers. And so we plan to bring the youth and some music and some movement to it as well. So it's going to be a fantastic time. A lot of the sister congregations in Sacramento are welcomed, and we're just going to have a wonderful experience on that day.
Well, real pleasure meeting you both. Thank you for being here and giving us all an education. The Reverend Ambrose Carroll, founder of Green the Church, and Michael Harris about the week-long celebration known as Kwanzaa, coming up a week from tomorrow. Thanks, both of you, for being on Insight.
Thank you.
And we have more on our website, of course, at capradio.org. As we head into a short break here, let's listen to Matunda ya Kwanzaa, a song written and composed by Kevin Davis. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio. Listening to Insight here on Cap Radio, I'm Randall White in for Beth Ruyak today. The National New Play Network is bringing the rolling premiere of Halftime with Dawn by playwright Ken Weitzman to the B Street Theater this month. The play tackles the mental and physical toll of a long professional football career on linebacker Don Devers. Joining us today is actor Rich Hebert, playing the character of Don Devers. Welcome to Insight. Nice to have you here.
Nice to be
and
here.
I know it's early for you.
Yes, it is.
We'll make it through. Also joining us today is Associate Artistic Director Lindsay Birch. Welcome to you as well.
Thanks so much for having us.
Yeah. So let's set this up for people. Don Devers was a celebrated NFL star linebacker for years. Now in his 50s, the toll of his job has decimated his body, but also his mind. He spends his days in his chair, subsisting on Gatorade and Pringles. Where does the play go from there, Don?
Lots of crunching and slurping.
All right,
from
just
the Gatorade
Don.
And the Pringles.
I'm sorry.
That's
I told you by your character name,
I'm
Rich.
There already. Yes. I'm in there. You know, he also had a law career afterwards, he cites some people who actually have become lawyers after pro football, including Steve Young.
Mm-hmm.
It's taken a toll on him. He's having outbursts, emotional outbursts and mood swings, and a lot of things are happening, and he's losing control of his life. And as a result, he's moved out from his daughter. He was living with his daughter, and his daughter has to be kind of a caretaker from afar because he isolates himself, and she's worried about his isolation, and he's not taking care of himself. But he reads a lot. He's a really smart guy. But, you know, he feels that loss of his mind, a dementia that's coming on, and he's quite aware of it, but he's also aware of the fact that he can get very angry and have these mood swings and do things that he doesn't want to do that are out of his character. So
yeah. Rich, it's a heavy topic, to be sure. Did you know much about CTE, which stands for chronic traumatic encephalopathy?
Yeah, that is a tough one.
Right?
Encephalopathy.
I did have to
at
go
one
that
point
slowly
in the show, I'm speeding out on overdoing my drugs.
Oh, okay.
And I have to say that very quickly. And it comes out different ways.
Right. Yeah, it does.
But I've kept an eye on it because I have I have some friends who I was in this area in I'm originally from Boston, and you might be able to hear it.
I was going
to
say, I would never guess.
And I was out here doing Les Miserables I was playing Valjean at the Curran in 89-90, and I got to know because we were Hamilton in those days.
Yeah,
and,
right.
And I got to know some football players. I got to know Steve Young. I got to know Joe Montana. I got to know Harris Barton. And Harris Barton, he was a lineman and has three rings. And so we talked a lot about football. And I played football in high school, and I had my share of concussions. So I've known about this. I've watched all the, you know, the front lines and the different programs that have been, and the film with Will Smith. And so I do know a bit about it. It's a really sad thing. And I mean, I'm looking at the toll, the numbers, you know, 1 out of 3 football players, 99% of the studies that they did on brains that they had donated, 99% of the football players have CTE or had it, you know? And so you're going to get it.
Yeah.
It seems to me. And so I worry. When I was doing Les Mis, I got to sing the national anthem at Candlestick for a football game.
For a Niner game, huh?
Yeah, and they brought me out on a limo and everything. It was great, and they let me stay on the field for the game, and so they were playing the Packers, and I was right on the field watching these guys hit each other, and when they talk in this play, I talk about it being a collision sport, you know, and
the impact was like a car crash.
It was like a car crash. I mean, when I played in high school, you know, I got hit a few times where I came walking off the field, you know, and the coaches, get back in there, and I'm like, no way, you know, but watching these giant men do it, it was just devastating watching the hits.
Rich, I'm going to have you slide into your Don Deavers character for a moment, you don't mind reading a little from the play. What leads up to this that you're going to read for us?
Well, the whole concept of the play is a former fan, a lifelong fan, comes to meet me, and I imparted some wisdom on him when he was young, and when he was, you know, I was his idol, and he's interviewing me, and so we're talking about the fact that I'm staying away from my daughter because I'm worried that I might hurt her.
Okay.
So this is what he says. It's not about the pain. You understand that, don't you? The pain is bad, but this is about my daughter and that child. But won't this hurt them, Don? What you're planning to do? That's your next question, right? And I answer, no, not physically. But what about emotionally? And I answer, she'll be spared. Spared the pain of having to visit her father in some nursing facility. Him not even knowing who she is. Seeing me deteriorate, stink from sitting in my own feces, slack-jawed and drooling from all the meds they pump into me to make sure that I don't injure the staff. Because those places, they're not prepared to handle guys like me with dementia. They're used to 80, 90-year-olds. Well, suddenly, these places are going to have to deal with younger guys, strong men, and their mood shifts. What are they going to do then, huh? What can they do other than sedate me? No, I'll spare her of all that.
Rich Hebert playing the character of Don Deavers for a performance at B Street Theater that's going on this month called Halftime with Don. It is brought to B Street by the National New Play Network. And Lindsay Birch is also joining us. She's the Associate Artistic Director. Lindsay, what did it take to bring this show and put everything together?
Well, so it's interesting. The National New Play Network has what you've noticed called a rolling world premiere, which is essentially a way for new plays to have a continued life past one initial production. A lot of times a play will get done once and then not get done again, or possibly get done again, but very far down the road. The rolling world premiere makes sure that the play gets done at least 3 times in a calendar year. So from the opening night of the first production to the opening night of the last production will all be within the same year. And we are actually the 3rd and currently final production of Halftime with Don in the Rolling World premiere, following New Jersey Repertory Theater and Phoenix Theater in Indianapolis. And part of it is, you know, I worked on this play in 2015 at the Eugene O'Neill Theater Center's National Playwrights Conference, and it was the one of the first times the play was being read and workshopped. And now, in the end of 2018, Bee Street's producing the play after it's already had these two productions. So it really speaks to the whole process of how a play starts. It's workshopped with many different possibly directors, cast, organizations until it does get a chance to be fully performed on the stage. And the way this one worked is, you know, we were interested in the play. I had brought it to Bee Street after getting a chance to work on it. And we found these two other partners in New Jersey Repertory Theater and Phoenix Theater in Indianapolis who said, we're also really interested in this play. We think it's timely. We think the writing is very poignant. There's moments of comedy and drama. It's just a really great piece. And so essentially what you do is you all partner together, but there's a rule that no production can have the same member of a creative team. Mm. So, and in that sense, every production is very different. They have to have different actors, directors, designers. And this is a way to give the playwright really a chance to see if the play holds up across different markets, different artists, really giving them a chance to see the production in many different ways. And actually, there's some funding associated with the Rolling World premiere, and a requirement is that part of the funding goes to bringing out the playwright twice, once during rehearsal and once during the run of the performances. So Ken will be out this coming weekend. He was out in early December to see rehearsals, and now he's going to come back and get to see the production. And he's gotten to do that all three times, which I think is an incredibly valuable thing for a playwright to do.
It's a great way to go about it, and I really appreciate you sharing a bit of the play with us today. Thank you so much. Actor Rich Ebert and Associate Director Lindsay Birch, Halftime with Dawn premieres at the Bee Street Theater this month. Thank you so much. That is Insight for today. I'm Randall White. Insight produced by Jen Picard, Bert Johnson, and Cody Drabble. Our digital team, Chris Hagan, Casey Gardner, and Emily Zentner. And our executive producer is Joe Barr, back with another live show tomorrow. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.